Dr. Google can't fix your knee. The Joint Relief Institute can. Fast joint pain relief, covered by Medicare. Call 708-888-0000, as in zero pain.
Well, welcome to After Hours with me, Rick Hogan, on this post-Hawks game thing. The Hawks are sports. I'm going to tell you about the best sports book I have read in memory. It is a masterpiece, not a masterpiece of sorts. It is a masterpiece. If you're buying one book for Christmas time, it has to be Ali, A Life by my guest, Jonathan Eich. I'll introduce you to John in 1 second. This is chapter one. And tell me, if you read this, you cannot keep reading and devouring this book. His great-grandfather was a slave. His grandfather was a convicted murderer who shot a man through the heart in a quarrel over a quarter. His father was a drinker, a bar fighter, a womanizer, and a wife beater who once, in a drunken rage, slashed his eldest son with a knife. These are the roots of Muhammad Ali, who was born with what he called the slave name Cassius Marcellus Clay Jr., and who ultimately became one of the most famous and influential men of his time. John, I welcome to the show. That's a great lead, as we used to say in the newspaper business.
Thanks.
You spent more than 5 years researching, writing, kind of being a detective, browbeating and chasing the Ali crowd to get them to sit for interviews. 600 interviews with roughly 200 people. Did you ever, during this, get tired?
Oh, God, no. This was the most fun I ever had in my life. I told my editor I'd like to keep working on the book until I die. I didn't want to ever turn it in because I was having so much fun.
What started you on this journey?
You know, I was having a conversation with Jane Levy, one of my favorite writers who did Sandy Koufax,
incredible,
Mickey Mantle.
Two incredible biographies.
Yeah, and she was thinking about doing Babe Ruth, and she called me to talk about it. And I said, oh, you got to do Babe Ruth. I would just love to read a Jane Levy book on Babe Ruth. Because other than Muhammad Ali, there's nobody more interesting than Babe Ruth.
Yeah.
And I hung
yeah.
up the phone and I said, wait a second, Muhammad Ali, oh my God. Nobody's done his biography yet. There have been a lot of great books.
You must have thought, though, even at the time, and even as much as you might have read about Ali, you had to think to yourself, in the millions of words that have been written about Muhammad Ali, there's got to be 120,000 of those words that tell the real story. You must have thought that.
Well, there are some great, great books.
No question.
That I could never touch, that, you know, by writers with far greater powers than any mere mortal like me. You know, Norman Mailer and George Plimpton and David Remnick have written wonderful books, but they all took little pieces of Ali's life. And I'm not sure why none of those writers had stopped to do the big 500, 600-page book. Maybe just not enough time had gone by.
Yeah.
Because they were writing when Ali was still active or had just recently retired. But now I come along and it's 50 years since he beat Sonny Liston and 50 years since he said, I got no quarrel with them Viet Cong. And now that's enough time that you can do the big fat biography.
Any attempt to, and a lot of this is in the book too, but any attempt to get him to somehow, or he and his people to somehow agree to allow you to do this, to write the conventional kind of authorized biography. I can see certain problems with that immediately. And you obviously saw hundreds of potential problems with that as you proceeded. Any thought to do that, John?
He came to me, actually, and asked me if I would turn this into an authorized biography. And they would give me more access to Muhammad, and they would give me more access to his wife.
And they wanted things from you, too.
They
though.
Wanted to control what I wrote, and that was a deal breaker. You know, the money wasn't had nothing to do with the money. I might have made more money, frankly, if I'd made a deal with them. But I didn't want – and I said to them that Muhammad Ali deserves a biography that's true, that's honest, that includes his flaws, because people aren't going to believe the good stuff if you don't tell them the bad stuff, too. And I just felt like he was an important enough figure that he needed an objective, unauthorized biography.
One of the great things about your career in books, with the exception of one book, is you have tackled these subjects, Al Capone, Lou Gehrig, where legend in many ways outshines truth. And as a result, you as the biographer has to dig for that truth that is not just overshadowed, but the legend. People love the legend.
Yeah, and we run the risk of losing these people. You know, they become myths. They become superheroes.
Yeah.
And, you know, Jackie Robinson is a good example.
Another example.
Guys who we turn them into these two-dimensional heroes, and we lose sight of them as real people. And I think that's a danger with Ali, too. We already have certain myths about Ali. You know, he was so angry about not being served in a restaurant that he threw his Olympic medal off the bridge into the river. Well, that never happened. And Ali admitted it never happened, but everybody still thinks it happened.
Why is that, John? I mean, you've been a newspaper man for most of your career and a biographer. Why do you think that happens? You know, is it the old, well, if the legend's better than the truth, print the legend?
Yeah, and I blame it on the media. I blame it on Hollywood a lot. You know, we just like these stories to be bigger than life. And after a while, you start to lose all the edge of these people, so they don't feel like real human beings anymore.
Yeah.
And I think that's a big mistake. I think that if you turn these people into two-dimensional characters, they're not really as heroic because they don't feel like somebody who you might have met along the way, somebody who's real.
Talk to me about his we're going to plow through the book with all my little notes. I can't believe he was on Cup Show. I had somehow forgotten.
That was a great interview.
I had forgotten that. I know. Here's a part. He's talking about Malcolm X. Well, we'll get to that. His father was really a, to put it mildly, a character.
Yeah, he was a drunk. He was he ran around with women. He beat his wife and beat his kids. And at the same time, he was this unbelievably charismatic, gregarious guy, the life of the party. So Ali clearly gets some of his personality from his dad.
And his womanizing, too.
And his womanizing,
too. That was another
too.
Revelation yeah, here. I think one of the legends is that, he was, you know, he had some beautiful wives and he had some beautiful daughters and he projected in many ways the image of as best a professional boxer can, I guess, the image of a family guy.
Yeah, family guy with four families, but it was beyond that. I mean, he was terrible to these women and had mistresses, you know, God only knows how many, hundreds in the hundreds, certainly. And he would have his wives book hotel rooms for his mistresses. Everybody knew it at the time, but he was the champ and it was the 70s. And
he was also terrible to his another revelation. There are a million revelations in it's one of the great covers. If you walk in a bookstore, you will see a giant fist, and behind that, the champ. He was also lousy to women in general, even his beloved mistresses, wasn't he? I'm just another aspect of his complex nature.
Yeah, he was callous. He thought mostly of himself and thought that as long as he was pleased, then the world would be pleased.
There's another interesting before we take a break, and I'm highlighting certain sections here that just jump out and stuff that I, who have read a lot about Ali, I've just fascinated by him since I was a young man. The fight he had with this neighborhood tough guy in 1958, this guy named Corey Baker, that's a lovely, it's not long, it's not even a page long. Why am I fascinated with that story, John?
Well, you know, Ali, all his life from childhood, first of all, he's dyslexic, so he's not able to get the kind of approval he wants. He needs to have attention. He's desperate for attention and affection. He can't get it from school, can't get it from his dad who's out drinking every night. But he finds boxing, and he discovers that, like, this big, strong thug in the neighborhood who terrorizes everybody else, if you put him in a ring, that young Cassius Clay can handle him. Cassius Clay knows how to box, and he's got this gift that just allows him to transcend all the rules of society. The rules say Corky Baker's tougher than him. The rules say white kids don't hit black kids don't hit white kids. The rules say that he can't be famous, he can't be rich, but boxing changes everything for Cassius Clay.
Fantastic. I'm talking this entire hour with John Eig, the masterful biographer of Jackie Robinson, Lou Gehrig, The Pill, and Al Capone. John and I have once had a famous, famous conversation in the world's hottest place during Printer's Row Book Fair. The book is simply titled Ali, A Life, and it is the compelling, artfully told story of one of the most complicated, charismatic men of any century. We'll be back in a moment after I tell you, play ball, celebrate the Cubs with team memorabilia, exclusive books, and so much more. Visit ChicagoTribuneStore.com today. We'll be right back with John Ike. Welcome back. Rick Hogan talking to John Ike for this whole hour, the beginning of near the beginning of Chapter 5 in his masterful, you know, I don't know why. People seem to want to buy this new Walter Isaacson book about Leonardo da Vinci. Leonardo da Vinci, I'll give you, was an interesting guy, but this was...
He wouldn't have lasted around with Ali.
He wouldn't have lasted about a barroom talk either. The other thing about Ali that a lot of people forget, I think, John, and you can tell me, is that, as you write here, beginning in 1958, Clay would make three trips to Chicago in 3 years. More than any other city, Chicago provided him with a pathway not only to adulthood and big city life, but also to new complexities defined by race and its consequences. Chicago played a huge part in Ali's life. He lived here for a long time. The Muslim faith was centered here. Talk to me about Ali in Chicago.
Well, he comes to Chicago for the first time to fight the Golden Gloves.
Right.
According to his story, he has sex here for the first time with a prostitute, but he also discovers the Nation of Islam. And, you know, just the rules in Chicago are different from... He grew up in Louisville.
Louisville, yeah.
Where there's, you know, segregation everywhere. In Chicago, at least, there's some integration. He sees things happening here that he wouldn't have seen in Louisville.
When he sees a much sort of freer and sophisticated black community here, too.
That's
where,
right.
Where he is... You know, over the years, is increasingly admired and revered.
That's right. And he hears people talking about this guy, Elijah Muhammad, and he hears this record called The White Man's Heaven is the Black Man's Hell, and he buys this record and takes it home and plays it in Louisville. It's recorded by Louis Farrakhan when he was still called Louis X. And this is his introduction to the idea that, you know, maybe integration isn't ever going to work and that the only way for black people is to carve their own path. And he becomes entranced by this at an early age.
Now, you must have listened to that, too.
Oh, yeah, I listened to their song.
How potent is it? I mean, you're listening to it years after, of course. You're white. It's a different time. But is it powerful enough that you can understand how the young Muhammad Ali could be so intrigued, attracted, and eventually devoted?
Well, yeah, you absolutely can. And obviously today there are a lot of people who feel like, hey, maybe he was right.
Yeah, no
black
kidding.
People were never going to get a fair deal. They're still not getting a fair deal. But for Ali, who grew up, he's the same age as Emmett Till, who sees what happens to black kids who give lip to white people. Maybe this is an alternative. Maybe the only way really is to start our own nation within the nation and force the United States to give us a chunk of real estate where we can make our own way and get out of this system. That's very appealing to a guy like a young kid, you know, teenager, Cassius Clay at that point.
He also, Chicago gave him beyond the religious aspects. He fell in love with the city in many ways, too, did he not?
Yeah, he did. Again, because it was different. There was more mixing here. He also fell in love with a girl here.
Yeah,
first and second wife. His first girl was from Gary, Indiana, his first wife. Second wife was Southside Chicago girl, mm-hmm. member of the Nation of Islam, married her when she was 17. So he had roots here in that way and ended up raising his kids here.
Yeah, yeah. Another great revelation for you folks, you've got to read the book. Just buy the book. I'm just giving you just tidbits. Page 115, in 1962, this is fascinating to me. You all remember the phrase, float like a butterfly, sting like a bee. That was invented by Bandini Brown, trainer, right? Or
yeah, that's
manager,
right.
Or whatever he was. But here, John writes this. In a 1962 New Yorker article, A.J. Liebling, who was one of the great writers about boxing and about newspapers and media and war, had written of the, quote, butterfly Cassius, end quote, who boxed with, quote, busy hands stinging like bees, end quote. No one knows if Bandini Brown read Liebling's descriptions or if he arrived independently at the idea that Clay's style bore comparison to butterflies and bees. That is fascinating to me. The whole notion of Bundini Brown sitting in some sweaty gym reading A.J. Liebling in The New Yorker just almost cracks me up. What do you think, John Ike?
I think he got it from Liebling, and I think Bundini was a great thief and was smart enough to trademark it. He was also smart enough to pawn Ali's championship belt at one point for $500. So, Bundini was a hustler. It wouldn't surprise me if he ripped off Liebling.
Some of the characters in this book, of the 200 or more people you interviewed, were terribly hard to get to. When you were doing much of this book, Ali was still alive, which I think, complicates matters a bit. But you had to trail him like the reporter you are, like a dog on the scent, didn't you?
It was so much fun, but it was crazy sometimes. And I tell these stories because the stories about me chasing these guys don't make it into the book, but I do have a podcast
right.
where I tell these stories. It's called Chasing Ali. You can find it on iTunes and anywhere else they have podcasts. But Don King, I had to literally chase him around the country and just follow him from restaurant to restaurant, from public event to public event, until he just got tired of seeing me and finally agreed to talk to me. And with Don King, he just goes into his spiel if you let him. So I had to force him to pay attention, to ask a question that would snap him out of his
Was he revelatory at all for you?
He was brilliant, actually. Yeah. He was really smart. I said to him, Don, how come nobody ever killed you? That was my first question to him.
Good.
I said, the Nation of Islam, you were ripping off fighters, taking money from them. You were dealing with the mafia. How come none of these guys ever killed you? And I think that got his attention, and we had a really good conversation after that.
Yeah, fascinating guy. There were some, I'm imagining, that you couldn't get to, who just either respected Ali's privacy enough or weren't interested in sitting down with you. There couldn't have been many, but there had to be a few.
I got almost everybody.
Wow.
His current wife, Lonnie,
who was very, very good to you,
was really helpful. She did not want to do the full-blown, long, days-long interviews that his other wives did. But she still coached me and gave me tips and welcomed me to her home. I think Larry Holmes was tough. He would not do it unless he got paid, but I still got him, and I didn't pay him.
Yeah.
These guys were...
How did you manage that? Use this as an example. I had on the show last week James Atlas, who has just written a book about writing biographies, and he was talking about the dance. But he wrote Saul Bellow's biography, which must have frankly been a nightmare. That took him 10 years. But the dance that one has to do with some of your subjects... How did you eventually convince Larry Holmes, who has never seemed like the world's brightest guy to me, to sit down with you? What was it?
Well, Larry Holmes, I basically just tricked. I found that he was being paid to show up at a public event, and his contract required him to talk to the press.
Oh.
So I showed up there, and I'd already called him 10, 12 times. And I said, Larry, guess what? I'm coming to Louisville for that event you're doing. And he said, USOB, you got me. All right, I have to talk to you because my contract says so. Yeah. But others, like his second wife, Khalila, who I ended up spending dozens of hours with, at first she said no, she wouldn't want to do it unless she got paid. But I started talking to other people, and I found a guy named Lowell Riley on the South Side who was the photographer for the Nation of Islam. And he had dozens of old pictures of Khalila from when she was a teenager. So I bought some of those pictures from Lowell, sent him to Khalila, and suddenly, she wanted more. So I said, I'll give you more when I come down to do that interview with you. And, just kind of worked my way into it.
It is. This is the first subject. Well, some of Jackie Robinson's family was alive, but there aren't any Capone relatives about it. It's a weird relationship that one has to form as a biographer with the living subjects about whom you're writing, isn't it? You obviously enjoy it. But it's still a strange kind of dance, is it not?
It is, and it's complicated, and you go through, it's like a relationship. You have your ups and downs, the moments when they're speaking to you and when they're not speaking to you. These guys know my kids because they call the house all the time, and Gene Kilroy, Ali's manager, got to know my family really well, but sometimes he'd be so mad at me that he wouldn't talk to me for months. And it just goes up and down, and I worked on this book, as you said, for almost 5 years, so... There's going to be hot and cold moments.
Did you think when you went in that it would take that long?
Yeah, I thought it was at least 3 or 4 years minimum. And some of it was just that I was having such a good time. But then a lot of these people took a while, as I said, to convince them to talk.
What was it, before we take a break, and you're going to stay on almost all the way till 11, and thanks for coming in, when did you first, you're younger than I, and when did you first become intrigued by Ali? As a young man?
Yeah, I had his poster on my ceiling when I
did
was
really?
11, 12 years old, and that was the mid-70s when he was fighting, you know, Frazier and Norton and Foreman. Those fights were bigger than a million Super Bowls.
Yeah.
They were the biggest thing in the world.
Into that. No
and I was too young to be allowed to go watch them on closed circuit at the movie theaters like the older kids were, but I you'd see them a week or two later on Wide World of Sports, and it would be the biggest thing in the neighborhood. Everybody would be talking about it.
Well, your fascination from an early age has been rewarded in your work. Ali, A Life is a magnificent book. If you don't have it, you're an idiot. We'll take a little break and then talk to John. I'll talk about, you know, we'll talk about specific fights. There's also this chapter where he and Frazier are in a car that is just remarkable. It's like a David Mamet play.
I love that. Yeah, someone should take a play out of that
no
chapter.
Kidding. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago and WGNRadio.com. If you're an Amazon Echo user, just say play WGN Radio on TuneIn and find John Ike's podcast, will you please? It is 10:30. We'll tell you how to find it. It's 10:30, and here with the news, Roger Badish. Thanks. This is Rick Kogan. I'm talking to John Ike about his astonishing book, Ali, A Life. Ali, one of the most intriguing figures in my life. Chapter 29, John Ike, is a conversation in Joe Frazier's gold-colored Cadillac in August 1970 between Muhammad Ali and Joe Frazier. Where did you find, as I said before, it has the makings of a spectacular play.
It's this great dialogue, and it's contained in Ali's autobiography, which was ghostwritten by Richard Durham. And it just goes on in this autobiography, and I found that it was, in fact, recorded. Richard Durham was sitting in the back seat with a tape recorder. So this is legit conversation, and the quotes just read like they're real. You know, it doesn't. A lot of the book is made up or polished beyond recognition, but this dialogue is legit, and it's this beautiful scene. Ali's out of boxing. He's been suspended for his refusal to fight in Vietnam. He's broke. He's begging Joe Frazier for a job as one of his sparring partners, and Frazier's doesn't want to hire him because it's humiliating. Ali deserves better than that. He says, "Just take the money. I'll lend you money."
Yeah.
And they're teasing each other. They're arguing over who's going to win when they do finally fight. It's a beautiful scene.
And, you know, Frazier here, and John Ag writes, Frazier handed Ali a $100 bill. Ali promised to pay him back the following week. More singing followed, and as they arrived in New York, Ali asked Frazier to open the Cadillac sunroof. In a couple chapters, they are squaring off in one of the great fights, and I mean great sporting events of the 20th century. I'm not being hyperbolic when I say that, am I, John?
No, it's the fight of the century, and it may be the greatest fight of all time, and it's the most important fight in Ali's career, I think, even though he loses, because it's his big comeback. It's the only time that two undefeated heavyweight champions have met. And it's just brutal. These guys just kill each other.
Well, you write, before the big bout, George Plimpton threw a party at Elaine's where Norman Mailer, Pete Hamill, Bruce J. Friedman, among others, held court. The writers and intellectuals talked about boxing's deeper meaning. That is one great sentence. Some of the writers knew a little about boxing, and a lot of others were just kind of like weird boxing groupies, right? But they talked about Ali, and somewhat irrationally, he had become a superhero to Muslims, poor black people, white liberals, hippies, draft dodgers, and just about anybody who believed the cards were stacked in favor of the establishment. I hope I'm giving you people out there a sense of John's incredibly stylish writing and the forcefulness of this narrative. That fight was seen by, I don't know, 30 million people, more?
It may have been the most widely viewed live event in history to that point.
Yeah.
I've checked it out. I think the moon landing was not watched around the world as widely as this fight was, because satellite broadcasts were just beginning to make these things available in other countries. And this was, you know, $5 million fight. They were each, you know, each man was getting $2.5 million, an unheard of sum at the time. More than each man was making more than Hank Aaron would earn over his entire career playing baseball.
Sure.
And everybody was there. This was just a...
You write another a really interesting observation here that if one thought about it, it took you to say it. The crowd, you write, and this was true. I saw this fight at the Chicago Stadium on closed circuit or whatever they called that in the day. But you wrote, and the crowd there was like this, too. You're writing, of course, about the fight itself. The crowd was multicultural before anyone used the term. An explosion of pride, a fun fashion show, a drug-addled parade of ego and power. Everyone was there. Among those verifiably in attendance and breathing the same stale Madison Square Garden air were Sinatra, Barbara Streisand. It's almost impossible to believe this. The Apollo 14 astronaut, Sammy Davis Jr., Colonel Harlan Sanders of Kentucky Fried Chicken fame, Hugh Hefner, Barbie Benton, who was Hefner's date and wearing a see-through blouse under a monkey fur coat, Hubert Humphrey, Woody Allen, Diane Keaton, Miles Davis, Dustin Hoffman, Diana Ross, Ted Kennedy, Ethel Kennedy, Mayor John Lisney, Burt Bacharach, Marcello Mastroianni, William Saroyan, Bing Crosby. Just astonishing. The other great fight, and it would not qualify as a... it qualifies as a very interesting boxing match, I think, and also something of a worldwide sensation, was Ali Foreman.
Yeah, in Zaire, of all places, which was Don King's brilliant idea.
Yeah.
Let's let a dictator pay us millions of dollars to bring the fight to his country so that Zaire might look a little bit better and a little bit less corrupt, as if tourists are someday going to flock to Zaire. But that's Mobutu thinks that it's worth paying these guys millions of dollars just to bring the fight there and make him a more important world figure. And it's the most it's the fight where Ali gets his title back finally,
yeah.
But nobody thinks he has a chance against big bad George Foreman,
who had destroyed Frazier, who had really sort of destroyed Frazier earlier.
Right.
That was the famous rope-a-dope fight, and if you have not seen it, you can certainly see it on YouTube, and you really do a remarkable job, and a lot of writers covered that. I mean,
Norman Mailer did a pretty good job on that one.
Norman Mailer famously, I think, I like Mailer as a writer, but I think he overwrote. He overwrote that, as he had a tendency to do.
Yes.
He overwrote his Marilyn Monroe book. I mean, he was a genius and a great writer, but he could overwrite. When you would read, it's a difficult thing, I think, as a writer, talented as you are, to read the especially about that, the amount of words written about that fight could be overwhelming. How do you sort it all out, John, and find your own voice and be able to take your own voice through all those other words?
Yeah, you have to read it and then try to forget about it, because often you find that there's a lot of baloney in there and a lot of stuff that didn't really happen. And, I'm lucky that a lot of these guys are still alive, so I can go back and interview them and get my own take on it, And again, with perspective, George Foreman says to me that he believes he was drugged before the fight by his own manager.
Mm.
Then he says to me that he gave the ref $25,000 cash to make sure it was a fair fight. And he's still mad because he says he found out later that Ali's camp gave the ref more than $25,000 cash. I called Ali's manager and I said, is it true that George gave them $25,000, gave the ref $25,000, and you guys gave him more than $25,000? And his manager says, that's ridiculous. That's the stupidest thing I ever heard. We only gave him $10,000.
How did you find Foreman to interview?
All these guys.
Because there is the post-boxing career of George Foreman is something out of P.T. Barnum, or it's one of the great American success stories. And, he was kind of seemed like a dope.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden he seems like the most affable, charismatic guy in the world. How did you find Foreman?
Boxers don't tend to end well, but Foreman did.
Yeah, no kidding.
But Foreman and Larry Holmes is the same way. They start out complimenting Ali. Foreman says, I was hitting him, and Ali says, is that all you got? Is that all you got, George? And you know what? That was all I had. Mm. I was washed up. I was tired. I couldn't fight anymore. And Ali, started punching and I went down. But if you talk to him a little longer, you start to hear the anger coming out. He's still a fighter and he's still pissed off that he lost that fight. And he still thinks he was drugged before the fight.
Mm.
Same thing with Larry Holmes. Larry beat Ali.
Yeah, right. Sure.
But he's still competitive. He still wants the world to know that, he could have beaten him worse, but he was taking it easy because Ali was in such bad shape by the end of that fight.
Fantastic. What was there, John, for you, any kind of, it's hard, I guess, in 5 years, and especially when you're sitting down to write it, any great revelation? I mean, I'm sure you realize that Ali was a more complicated human being than anyone, as an observer and a reader of everything written about him would ever come to know. But the portrait you paint of him is not just a one of complexity. It is it's just so multi. He's like many people, if you dig deep enough, multifaceted in so many different ways.
Yeah, he's almost impossible to figure out sometimes. Yeah. And for example, you know, what's the thing that he's most renowned for? Well, it's for his stance against Vietnam, for saying that I got no quarrel with Viet Cong. And then in the mid 70s, somebody asked him if he had any regrets in life, and he said, "Yeah, the only thing I really regret is that thing I said about Vietnam." So what are you talking about? That's the thing that you're going to be, you know, most remembered for, perhaps. And I think the issue with Ali was that he really wanted to be loved more than he wanted to be admired.
Yeah.
And those the urge to rebel was always at war with him, with the urge to be loved, to be adored. And I think it goes back to his childhood and all his life. You see that fight going on within him.
Yeah, you do an amazing job. I've got a short commercial break, and then I'm going to keep John for about 10 more minutes. I also, John, how do people find your podcast?
ChasingAli.com.
It's a fascinating, even more insightful than the hour we've had here. It's wonderful about the many attempts to meet Ali. I mean, here he is alive. Were you at all, I know you did try to meet him, but were you at all reluctant to meet him, or was the pull too great to, you know what I mean?
No, I really wanted to at least look him in the eye. He hadn't done an interview in 20 years, so I knew he wasn't going to do an interview, but I wanted to at least meet him and shake his hand and tell him I was doing this and maybe see if I could get him to say something.
Yeah.
And I did finally get to meet him,
but
it was a brief meeting.
We'll take a short break, and I'll say goodbye to John after asking him a couple more questions. Again, the book is Ali, A Life. It is as compelling a cover as you've ever seen, and the payoff is between the covers. This is Chicago's, what am I telling you? Oh, just a break, that's all, just a break. We'll be right back. Okay, I got three more minutes with John Eig, and I want to talk about, there's so many, and I hope I've told you enough about the book, Ali, A Life, to make you go to the bookstore tomorrow or to go on your computer tonight and order this thing. There are two completely new sort of bodies of research that John partook of. You were curious about the toll that boxing had taken on Muhammad Ali's life.
Yeah.
And so you employed people who could figure it out for you.
We counted the number of punches that he was hit with. We counted every punch, round by round, of every fight. And you can see that in the beginning of his career, he's so fast, he's not getting hit much. And by the end of his career, he's so slow that he's getting out-hit dramatically by his opponents. And I calculated that he was probably hit about 200,000 times.
Must have been for you a fan and a great admirer of his skill as a boxer. Very sad.
It was. And you know, he keeps announcing his retirement over and over, and then he keeps coming back and fighting again. And I'm practically like yelling at him in my office, stop it, please, stop it, don't fight again. And the other thing I did, because he starts saying, I think something's wrong. You know, do you think my voice sounds wrong? Am I mumbling? And you can hear it in these interviews with him that his voice is slowing down and it's getting softer and he's mumbling.
You had people evaluate.
So I worked with scientists at Arizona State to study his speech patterns, and we saw that he lost 26% of his speaking rate from age 30 to age 40. And
it is a sad, sad way to go. And you do the epilogue of this book is haunting beyond words. After you go, you wrote his obituary for the Wall Street Journal.
I did, yeah.
Where John used to work. John was in the day a great newspaper and a magazine writer. Now he's a great book writer. The funeral is, to me, was very, very sad. Because I think those last 20 years of his life were not happy ones. Do you think there was any happiness for him somewhere in those years, John?
You know what he liked to do the most in his last years? He liked to watch himself on YouTube. Yeah, he'd watch his old TV interviews with Howard Cosell. He'd watch his old fights. And, I mean, what could be more fun than that? If you know, I would, too, if I were Muhammad Ali. He was so beautiful. He was so special.
It is quite a book. It is 500 pages, more than 500 pages, that read like a great short story, because it's one thing coming after another. And if you think you know, well, I know Muhammad Ali, you don't until you've read Jonathan Eig's Ali, A Life. It's a very simple title, you know, not hard to Google, not hard to find, and it is also the perfect Christmas gift, especially because there's a generation now that doesn't remember him, that doesn't remember him in the way that John and certainly I do, and this is one of the great towering figures of the 20th century. No question about it. John, congratulations. I've loved all your books. And I don't know which one of these, you know, truth to legend guys you're going to do, guys or women you're going to do next, but I sure look forward to it.
Well, thanks. This is a lot of fun.
It is. It always is. And I will see you soon. Now, for your listening pleasure, ladies and gentlemen, my dear friend, the young critic, Zita Moore, went to see the new show at a Red Orchid Theater. Full disclosure, Zita's mom, Natalie Moore, the talented actress formerly of Remains Theater, is in the show. Zita's been doing reviews for this, for my various incarnations of this program for, maybe 10 years, since she was about 8 years old. We were going to play this a couple weeks ago, pre-Halloween, but, you know, it's always Halloween. Here is Zita Moore.
Imagine a world where theater has died. The vanishing image of a beloved medium dangles over a treacherous precipice, screaming for its life. If it's too much for you to stomach that image, take heed when seeing Evening at the Talkhouse, written by Wallace Shawn and directed by Shade Murray at a Red Orchid Theater. We are met with tension in the form of a group of artists reuniting for what's supposed to be a pleasant evening. Instead, we learn that Robert, a slimy writer played by Lance Baker, and his right-hand man Tom, a slick TV actor played by Miguel Nunez, and dubious members of the gentry, Annette and Ted, played by Kirsten Fitzgerald and Doug Vickers, respectively, are charged with a chilling profession, which they adhere to with a nonchalance that chills your blood to ice. It comes as a welcome relief that Bill, played with addictive bitterness by Noah Simon, peppers the play with a whip of inquisitive dialogue that lances through the actions of the troubling company. It's all we can do to root for Nellie, played with heartbreaking open-heartedness by Natalie West, the proprietor of the establishment and protector of the vulnerable. Her compatriot, Jane, played by Sadia Rifai, shines with the lopsided halo of hope in the cracks of darkness that seem to shatter over Dick, played with tremendous heart and soulfulness by H.B. Ward. As the mysteries come to the limelight and the facade of welcome bleeds into the polished floorboards of doom, I imagine the audience will come to a reckoning over what our society has become in regards to a pleasure-seeking sinkhole full of paranoia and a longing for oblivion. This play slices you in the gut and dares you to watch the devil dine on your entrails outside your body. It's that good. Out of all of the productions I have had the utmost privilege of seeing at a Red Orchid Theater, this one takes the cake for its potency. Rest assured, laughs present themselves, but at a price. You have been warned that you'll regret not seeing this magnificent grim fantasia. It's perfect for Halloween.
Zita Moore on her mom's show, the hit show at a Red Orchid Theater. John Eig, this book, the reviews of this book, Ali, A Life, has been magnificent. You've got to be, you must now, maybe at this stage, sick of talking about Ali.
No, I don't think I'll ever get sick of talking about him.
You don't seem to be.
No, it's Ali. I mean, what could be more fun than talking about Ali?
Yeah.
You know, and I love all my books, but Ali is such an exciting figure. And the reaction you get from people, you know, some people still hate his guts.
I know.
It's still really visceral for a lot of people. And but people still love him, too. And it's so much fun to talk about.
Well, just reading about Ali being on Cup Show is just, it's like, just too much. John, continued success. You deserve a rest. This book was exhausting, but I can sense in your voice the palpable joy you had doing this, and that's what, if you're going to invest 5 years in doing a book, and that's, I think that's what Jim Atlas told me. I think he invested 10 years on and off on Saul Bellow.
Yeah, Ollie's way. Again, Ollie would knock out Bellow.
Yeah, he'd take Saul Bellow in a
heartbeat. Everybody should write a book about Muhammad Ali.
In a heartbeat. Thanks. It's great to see you, John. I don't know if I got an hour next week or not, but I will be here. Thanks for listening. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago and WGNRadio.com.